It shouldn't be robotic. It should be organic. It should be anywhere, anytime. It should be part of a world where we're all co-creators of our own learning experience. And teachers who have had an opportunity to lead that, Emma, they've done so with such fierce passion. That's been the game changer.
Welcome to Sage Advice, the podcast where the future of higher education is not just discussed, it's crafted. Every episode, we dive deep into the transformative world of learning, bringing you conversations with the pioneers and policymakers who are reshaping education today. Joining you from the innovative halls of Western Governors University, I'm your host, Chris Bunnell.
Today is an absolute treat because we have the trailblazing Dr. Lisa Herring with us. Dr. Herring is a powerhouse in the edutech space and a true champion for student success. With an impressive 24-year career in education, Dr. Herring draws on her experience as a teacher and administrator across urban and rural environments, to now serving in a national capacity as the president of Propel, a first-of-its-kind innovation and learning hub for the HBCU community. Dr. Herring is consistently recognized for her leadership in securing private-public partnerships with Fortune 500 companies that foster stronger career pathways and transform learning experiences for students. And that's not all. Dr. Herring was recently appointed as a strategic advisor to the U.S. Secretary of Education, Miguel Cardona, under the Biden-Harris administration. She is a true future-focused thought leader. And guess what? She is right here with us. So welcome, Dr. Herring.
Thank you, Emma. It's my pleasure to join. I'm super excited. It was a very kind intro, and it just aligns very appropriately with my passion for this work and the opportunity for us to engage.
That's terrific. So Dr. Herring, at Western Governors University, every student comes to us with a story and a dream. And I would like to start at the beginning of yours. Can you tell us about where you grew up and what experiences sparked your interest in education?
Absolutely. I grew up in a city called Macon, Georgia. It's about an hour south of Atlanta. Although people may know of Atlanta, hands down, sometimes when they're not sure about Macon, I like to joke and say, well, it's the home of Otis Redding. It's the home of the Allman Brothers. It's the home of Little Richard. And in education, it's the home of Lisa Herring. So I'm an hour south of Atlanta and went to school there from first to 12th grade in public school. And I'm a Georgia native, Georgia Peach, right? So after finishing high school, I went to college in Atlanta at our nation's number one HBCU, Historically Black College and University, Spelman College. And then from there, started an amazing career that has allowed for me to both teach, serve as a school counselor, do administration work in multiple states, particularly around the Southeastern United States. And at the end of the day, I am this little girl who's been given the gift to live a dream, to do something that she loved. I loved learning as a child. I loved reading. I would get lost in books. I'm the proud mother of one adult daughter, Amani. I see myself in her when I see that appetite for a book, the library, or to always want to know more, that natural curiosity. I grew up in a household with three brothers, so I can pretty much manage a room with gentlemen. But when I wanted to get away, I would find a great book and I would hide. I would hide under the bed. I would hide under the trampoline, or I would hide at the library. And nothing about that has changed for me. Reading opened up a world of discovery. And on my journey in education, I've wanted that for every child. I think over the last few years, what I've also seen, and maybe we'll talk about this, happened about 12 years ago. I can't unsee a different approach to learning, though, that doesn't eclipse the power and beauty of a good book, right? That I still love a good book, to touch the page, to smell a book, and then jump into the story. But in the age of technology and innovation, there is an imperative for us to also marry the two, to not just utilize the power of a good book, but the integration of technology so that we open up worlds for our young people that would not have otherwise existed. So that's that. That's part of what drives me. Very passionate. Being a mother drives me. had the gift to teach and work with young people in different capacities drives me tremendously. It actually is what I like to say, puts me on fire. When my brain catches on fire, I'm a totally different person. I'm at the edge of my seat. That's new information, new ideas, innovation, co-creation, disrupting all the things. So I'll stop there.
I love that. And as we think about maybe more classical education models, like you said, with a tangible book in your hands, hiding under the trampoline, and how we can marry that model with more innovative ways of pedagogy and utilizing technology, I wanted to share with our listeners that while you were with the Atlantic Public School System, you established the Ed Farm Teacher Fellows, Innovation Fellows, and Code Clubs. And during your tenure, the school system realized exponential corporate partnership growth. And we talk a lot about how education should be tailored to a student's needs and their experiences. So how did those initiatives help students feel a sense of place and belonging in schools? And can you speak to the importance of that?
Absolutely. And I really love the question. I have had the gift of an assignment of serving as superintendent for over 7 years, right at 7 years, quite candidly. But as I shared 12 or 13 years ago, my eyes opened when I was able to lead our system then in Charleston, South Carolina, to be a recipient of a federal grant, which was Race to the Top at the time. It was an opportunity to learn more about personalized learning, one-to-one learning, proficiency, work, mastery, all the things. But I saw something in students that opened up that I couldn't unsee, and I have been on a mission since. As superintendent, I've been given the opportunity to leverage those ideas and co-create with corporate partners. My message for the last 6 years or 7 years has also been our imperative is that children should leave us in the educational system. Either I call them the four E's, already employed, if they're able to get their credentials and skills before they graduate, they should leave us already employed, already entrepreneurs. We have students who code who are in middle school and elementary school, who've started their own websites and who are creatives. So if they're not already employed, we can help co-curate their entrepreneurial skills. They should also be able to consider being enrolled. And of course, if there's a choice for enlisting, that's something that they can pursue. So I would call those the four E's. I will tell you, over the last year, I thought about a fifth E, which is really tied to emotional intelligence and awareness that I think is just as critically important during the time and age of mental health. Partners get this. What I've learned from partners like Google, from partners like Nike, from corporate partners across our overall ecosystem, they're looking for the opportunity to fill gaps for their workforce right now. They're asking us, how will scholars be ready before they graduate? How can we step in and partner with you and help curate experiences and also provide credentials before they leave, expose them to career so that if they don't have it top of mind, it will be before graduation, so that they're not sitting in their freshman year thinking about a major that they've said yes to that they really don't want to pursue. Now, a lot of that is also tied to the experiences that students have in middle grades and high school when we start to do career interest inventories and we start building those high school four-year plans. But there's something powerful when partners say, how can we invite our workforce into your classrooms? Or how can we make your classroom a part of our workforce? When we start those conversations, quite honestly, Emma, it becomes a different game changer and it changes the game. Students become that much more excited because they're that much more informed and they get to learn very early around opportunities that can help actually change the trajectory of their lives. And for corporate partners, it changes the overall strategy around having a very well-skilled workforce before a student graduates. So imagine at graduation, if it's to a 2 or 4 year college or university that you go, but if you got those credentials in beforehand, you walk across the stage and you have an opportunity to go straight to work because you're skilled for highly skilled, high qualified, high paying jobs. And that's the reality of the world that we currently live in.
Those hands-on career experiences that you talk about and design with Google and Nike, those don't sound dissimilar to the experience that a future teacher has with their student teaching, which is a part of becoming a licensed teacher. And as a former superintendent, you were responsible for hiring teachers in various communities. At WGU's Teachers College, we're interested in helping states get teachers into the classroom. And that's obviously been a challenge for many states. School districts are settling back into the spring semester amid a dire teacher shortage. There are tens of thousands of vacant positions across the country. And I just read a study that said 160,000 teaching jobs are being filled by individuals who are underprepared to teach the content that they're teaching. That's a big challenge. And of course, there's no one-size-fits-all solution. Every community comes with its own set of challenges. Now, you have served in administrative roles in both rural and urban communities in various states. Can you speak about some of the various staffing challenges that you've seen in urban and rural communities, and maybe more broadly?
Absolutely, I can. You know, it's funny, over the last 3 years, particularly with the interruption of the global pandemic, one of the things that I've always had to monitor before I was superintendent, I was chief academic officer, deputy superintendent. My portfolio has for many years included the teaching and learning department or division, if you will. But one of the things that in the districts that I've worked in, we've taken great pride in, particularly in Atlanta over the last 3 years, is with a workforce of 6,000 employees, we would start the first day of school. That's always a goal for a superintendent, with as few teacher vacancies as possible. We were able to maintain less than 10 vacancies. That's singled out, pushing to single digit. It sounds like it's an impossibility. I remember last fall, CNN wanted to do an interview about the teacher shortage. And when I was sharing with them, because I'd interviewed with them before, where we weren't as much of a compelling story because we didn't have the shortage that our neighboring districts had. So what is that about? That's really the essence of your question. So number one, it's tied to how we take up strategic action towards valuing the role of the teacher. Value can come in many places. It's not just in teacher compensation and having competitive salaries. We still sit globally as a country that has to revisit how we look at teacher compensation and just actually value and honor the role of the classroom educator. But beyond that, teachers are also deeply passionate and curious about professional growth without the burden of cost. So how can we provide incentives for them to either secure additional degrees or credentials, and also to advance but still be in the classroom, utilizing them for their own ability to move into their next level of education? And they're not always aspiring to be principals and superintendents. They want to be the very best teacher that they could possibly be. Over the last 3 years, we also had intentionality around ensuring that beyond the organization's EAP programs, employee assistance programs, that we were very intentional around providing additional resources that were teacher specific, right? So whether that meant we were trying to provide specific counseling, on-demand counseling for classroom teachers during a very challenging time, or helping them become first-time home buyers, or making other incentives available, that was a difference maker. And just two more things, Emma, and there are tons, but for time, two more. The other that I would name is I have, since I became a chief academic officer, maybe back in 2012, have always had a teacher advisory council in every district that I've worked in. So the teacher of the year at every school was a part of that council, met with them monthly, and they advise me on the voices of their teachers and their teacher peers within their schools. And we utilize those voices to build teacher agency. You mentioned Ed Farm earlier. So this is the last piece, and it's innovation. There are teachers who have had this tremendous appetite to figure out how do they innovate within the classroom. Some of them have been so transparent and have said, listen, my students were doing great. I'm not quite sure why I need to take on a new skill. But when they were exposed to their own credentials for learning how to navigate through Apple credentials, micro-credentialing and badging, in addition to being able to learn how to best use devices and to eliminate this notion that the devices would replace the teacher, but would simply enhance what happens in the classroom, they caught on fire. They told other teachers. That number continues to grow. And it is an imperative that we not look at what happens in the classroom as the same experience that occurred when you and I were in school. It is not this notion of sitting with five rows with five chairs, both horizontally and vertically, that the classroom is the world, and that anywhere, anytime learning is a reality that we must embrace, but we have to also empower. It's like my daughter would say to me when she was a senior in high school. I remember one morning she said, "Do you ever feel like a robot, Mom?" And I said, "A robot?" She's like, "Yes, it's like the same thing every day." And then she challenged me. She was like, "And what do? You help lead school systems. We should be doing more." And even that private personal challenge was true. It shouldn't be robotic. It should be organic. It should be anywhere, anytime. It should be part a world where we're all co-creators of our own learning experience. And teachers who have had an opportunity to lead that, Emma, they've done so with such fierce passion. That's been the game changer. And it has to start with a classroom teacher, regardless of whether it's K-12 or post-secondary.
Those career development opportunities and resources are critical to any career. But as a teacher, that feedback loop changes with every cohort of students. So these opportunities to upskill and enhance their teaching capabilities really helps keep teachers in the classroom and helps keep their students engaged, as you say, so they don't feel like robots like your daughter.
Even with Capel, one of the things we offer faculty fellowships, right? And with faculty across 30 institutions, these are colleges across the country, we bring in faculty and we help provide training and opportunities for them, whether it's in these untapped areas, artificial intelligence, how do I infuse that into my curriculum? Whether it's this notion of coding and what does that mean for me as an instructor? Or if it's other ways of navigating the world of technology. We have found that at the post-secondary level, there's this missing opportunity to just allow that as a part of professionally developing those who are in front of our scholars, whether they are virtually engaging them or whether they're doing it with the traditional brick and mortar. It is an imperative that everyone hasn't embraced as an imperative. But I tell you, Emma, I know that it is because our scholars are often already ahead of us. So again, whether it's a 16-year-old or a 26-year-old or a 36-year-old, if there's some savviness around their ability to navigate devices and how they learn, then we have to catch up. And as the same space with artificial intelligence, I've had the good fortune to have several conversations directly with Sam Altman. And that's why we see even now, as we look at ChatGPT, OpenAI, we're figuring it out in real time. How do we catch up in our world with integrating this into our curricula? It's a real challenge, but it's not an impossibility.
Well, I want to jump into Propel then, since you've led us there. I'm fascinated by this. At Propel and at WGU, your courses are co-developed by industry experts and esteemed faculty. And this partnership with industry leaders has led to tremendous outcomes for our students. And I know the same is true at Propel. So can you speak to the importance of partnerships in designing the curricula and helping students succeed in the workforce?
I absolutely can. And so noting that Propel has existed now for about 3 years, our founding funders were Apple and Southern Company, an energy company that is very well known nationwide, but they're headquartered here in Atlanta, Georgia. Both the CEOs, Tim Cook of Apple and CEO Chris Womack of Southern Company, had this passionate belief around this opportunity to invest, not just in the historically Black college and university ecosystem, but in the world of education to ensure that there was this level of readiness for preparedness. So let's just take one of our areas that I just left a meeting earlier today discussing, cybersecurity. So how do we start to fill the workforce gap while also at the same time build capacity in instructors while also working to engage opportunities for students who are interested? Those three areas of opportunity are part of our focus. Corporate partners are looking for not just an investment to say we gave time and funding to an organization, but the return on that investment becomes multifaceted. Universities then begin to offer courses that are very work relevant, right? We are also able to provide opportunities for students to partner with companies, whether those are apprenticeships and what we offer in Propel, which is what we also call our accelerators, which becomes an opportunity to work with what you mentioned earlier. We call them subject matter experts. So whether they're with the Department of Energy or whether they are with Southern Company or whether they are in health and innovation or some of the other fields, we even do arts and entertainment. Subject matter experts are critical. They work in tandem with faculty. They work in tandem with students. And then we work to co-create curricula that we offer on the Propel Learn platform. And that becomes how we're able to interface throughout the ecosystem of our nearly 80 HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities, to ensure that there is a network and a platform for learning. And we've been very excited in a short window about the success, and we're looking forward to more.
Wow, 3 years. That is still a very young organization for all that you have accomplished already. And you mentioned earlier that you're a graduate of Spelman, the number one HBCU in the nation. And now you work with Propel, an organization designed to uplift HBCUs. Does it feel like a full circle moment for you? And how does your experience at Spelman inform your work today?
Well, that's a very personal and professional question. I taught at Spelman to fall 2022. I was the instructor for an educational studies course focused on urban education. Oddly enough, that was the same course that my daughter took when she was a student at Spelman. She graduated in 2019. As the two things, because we love saying this as alum, as the number one historically Black college and university in the United States, and as an institution uniquely designed for women, it has become full circle because that journey for me not only shaped who I am today as a leader, as a woman, as a Black woman leader, as an educator, as an innovator, as a corporate partner, as a CEO, as a superintendent, all things outside of my own experience of being born and raised in my parents' household, all things also from an educational standpoint tie back to Spelman. Dr. Helene Gale, who is president of Spelman and also a friend and colleague that I greatly admire, and I have had the opportunity to have conversations around the power of the experience. Post-secondary, as you well know, Emma, is this opportunity for us to not only adult or go through adulting. You remember not too long ago that became a very powerful term, we're adulting, but to also identify who you are and learn or at least shape where you're going if that's your journey. For me, it not only gave me voice, but it also gave me the opportunity to stay true to my voice and who I am and to have the confidence to walk in that. So to that end, I'm confident about my passion around innovation and education. It is unapologetic because it has to be. I am a champion and a warrior for children, whether they are K-12 or post-secondary. And that's where I developed my initial learning and understanding of the power of education. So yes, it is full circle. And it's my honor to refer to Spelman in that way.
And how terrific that you're now able to give back to your alma mater and uplift all HBCUs across the U.S.
It's life-changing. It is something that we know is also an imperative to get right. In our initial space as an organization that is both a little bit of a 501c3, but absolutely a startup, we want to make certain that our founding funders and future funders see immediately a return on their investment. But at the end of the day, that return is grounded in the success of students and faculty and institutions, much like the work that happens with WGU. So we're not a part in that. So no, that's without question. It's an honor to lead in that way.
So I want to come back to education, Dr. Herring. I want to come back to your time as a superintendent and the teacher shortage, because this is something that we talk about with policymakers all the time. And one thing that has become almost an axiom in this space is that a contributing factor to the shortage is that not enough young people are interested in becoming teachers. And at WGU's Teachers College, the median age of our students is 32. So we're frequently educating paraprofessionals that want to become teachers or maybe someone who's on their second career. Can you speak to your experience with this population who's maybe a little older than the traditional new teacher with a little more life experience and how they persist in classrooms?
Yeah, so twofold, if I may, in terms of my response. The course that I taught at Spelman, the urban education course, one of the things I learned with my students was that they were troubled by outdated syllabi. So the syllabus has to be relevant to the experience or the expectation that students have, whether they are 21 or 26, et cetera. And they know, because they're already brilliant and we live in a world where you can access information by a matter of a few keystrokes, if the readings are archaic, if it's not relevant. So I co-created my syllabus for my course with my students. And what we created was powerful because it was a combination of what they thought was imperative. They were seniors. This was a senior seminar course. They had already completed student teaching. Some of them were doing their field work. And at the end of my course, they were going to be good to go. So they had a lot of questions based on those experiences. So let's not minimize the power of experience, but also let's be candid about the importance of relevant curriculum, relevant curricula or syllabi, right? So that's number one. We talked about their experiences, and I found it important in many of our class sessions to give them time to share some of the challenges of what they were experiencing in real time through student teaching, which is true if someone's already served as a teacher assistant or a paraprofessional, even if they're just trying to figure out how they want to move. Something about education called them into the field, right? Something about education helped them decide that this was their assignment to now be a teacher. I think it's important that beyond the relevant curriculum and the innovative syllabus, that any exposure to real experiences is also a game changer. I brought principals into my course, and I had roundtables with principals, and students just asked the most powerful questions. I brought in the head of HR into my class so that my chief HR human resource officer could talk about the look fors and the challenges and to be real about the work. I also said, and we're competing with neighboring districts, we should also think about what is it that students need in real time to be able to student teach or to be in school and work. So we upped our ante on what we offered. We offered for our student teachers technology. We offered them a laptop. We increased a stipend for them for the semester because that's additional income. That was important. We partnered them with a master teacher beyond the person that they had who was tied to their student teaching. And we gave them a little bit more opportunity to professionally develop, which was beyond the class. Because it's become a challenge for us to highlight teaching as the thing that everyone wants to do, we're competing with a lot. I think it's important that when we think about how we compete, we think about who we're competing with. One of the last task force that I created was for us to look at with our teacher advisory council, how do we revisit the teacher schedule, the master schedule, so that in the way that we were losing teachers to educational firms was because they could work from home, was because they could work 3 to 4 days out of the week and they had time off, but they were still able to do the work. But we're still thinking 5 days, 8+ hours, extra duty, extra pay. We have to revisit that. And I think those who are more seasoned have a sense of that, and it only helps them think about how they too can co-create an experience to go into the classroom. The last thing I will say, Emma, is I'm going to go back to innovation. I'm most troubled in the space where we simply want to make certain that we help everyone understand that we've got to have a classroom that competes globally. And what does that look like? Whether it's virtual or face-to-face, who are we competing with as those who offer training and credentialing programs? And I just want to make certain that that is always top of mind, because our students should leave us feeling that they are globally competitive, and our teachers should have that same sense of the classroom that they own. Those are the things that I've seen from seasoned individuals who have chosen to go the path of education, and to also dispel the myths, right? Now, that's the last thing I'll say. Favorite statement that someone told me, well, everyone believes that they are an expert in education because they went to school. Well, that's not how it works. We all went to school in some capacity. That does not make us an expert. So to really honor the power of the classroom teacher is to help one understand that it does require credentialing and also expertise and a patience and a grace that's just not for everyone. And that is beyond more than just the most honorable thing you can do. Were it not for a teacher, we would not be able to have any of our other careers. So I'll just name that.
It truly is the most noble profession. And our VP of the Teachers College, Stacey Ludwig Johnson, was also recently on this podcast. And she was saying that teaching is the most noble profession because it is the one that all other professions rest upon. It all rests upon that education that you receive. And I love what you said about how we need to be globally competitive, because I don't think people think enough about how their classroom experience and the experience of the teacher really has an impact on our nation's economy.
It does. And I will tell you, in so many ways, right? And imagine, just imagine, if you will, states that we are experiencing teacher strikes, where we're talking about compensation or beyond compensation recognition, or the teacher who feels threatened in the classroom. There's so many layers of issues that it's important and imperative that we look at the experience of the teacher and how what happens in education is not just graduating a student, but quite honestly shapes and impacts the trajectory of the workforce, right? It shapes and impacts the trajectory of voting, like all the things. Like, this is where we learn and are informed about many things that are tied to our life experiences, both professionally and to a degree personally. I don't want to get into a debate there, but there's just so much power in the classroom that we must get that correct. We must, for the sake of our country and our world. Yes.
WGU is really trying to close the gap between access and attainment. We know that if we have teachers from more diverse backgrounds within the communities in the schools that they're supporting, the outcomes for those classrooms improves. We know that those teachers stay in the classroom longer. And while half of all public school students are students of color, only 6.7% of public school teachers are Black and 9.4% are Hispanic. We also need more men as teachers. This is a systemic challenge. Could you speak about your experience and the challenges that you've observed and maybe possible solutions that we're not talking enough about?
So, you know, Emma, the other truth is that throughout my 20 plus year career, I've worked in urban school districts in urban settings where the majority of students served were of color, right? And so I say of color, Black and brown students, right? And in a space where every district that I've worked in, so I'll call them out. I've worked in Charleston, South Carolina. I've worked in Birmingham, Alabama, DeKalb County, Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia. I worked in Columbia, South Carolina. I worked in a private school in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but worked around Allegheny County. And in all those spaces and places, I never saw enough male teachers. And students of color did not see themselves represented in the classroom as well as they should be. And why is that important? It's the same reason why it's important that all of us need to be able to self-identify, see ourselves in a space where they say to themselves, that could be me. I can do that. But when we talk about culturally relevant and responsive pedagogy and representation, people get uncomfortable. And it saddens me that we get uncomfortable because it's just an imperative. Everyone should have a sense of belonging within the classroom. I applaud efforts like Call Me Mister, the Call Me Mister program or initiative that is directly tied to helping onboard men of color into the classroom and give them reasons to understand why it's important, or whether it's also Teach for America. And I'm not just naming, I'm not promoting for the sake of promotion. These are some of the entities that I've worked with as a superintendent and as a chief academic officer. You know, at the end of the day, our data is clearly indicative of the fact that young boys of color oftentimes struggle the most in the classrooms, particularly in areas such as reading and mathematics for proficiency levels. And when we've been intentional around not only providing culturally relative and responsive programming, but also partnering and mentoring so they can see themselves, that too becomes a difference maker. It's not just a statement, it's a fact. I think there's enough research and science out there to support that. But it is controversial. And at the end of the day, that's the problem. It's controversial, and we have to find a way to come to the table. And I think sometimes the most common and effective way to do that is to start with the data.
Thank you, Dr. Herring. I would also love to talk a little bit about our model at WGU. So as you know, Western Governors University utilizes a competency-based education model where students can apply what they know to their studies and move through the material at a pace that works for them. Can you tell me about your experience with competency-based education?
I can. And so I go back to a few years ago when we started our work with one-to-one learning, and we looked at proficiency scales and mastery and student mastery as a means of performance. We entertained the notion of eliminating the traditional ABCDF report card and looking at proficiency scales to be able to identify student work and performance. It took some time to build an understanding around that approach. And quite candidly, it's still a work in progress. But when we think about the notion of competency-based instruction, and that gives much more leverage and autonomy, if you will, and ownership to the learner, that becomes the difference maker. For me, in both my work in South Carolina, and also even in more recently in Atlanta, that caused us to then create a different approach to reimagining what high school should look like. That's something that I hear often, even with my work with the Department of Education. It is now an imperative that we reimagine high school, that we pull our brains away from the traditional model of assessment. And that, too, is a critical factor when we think competency-based. Quite honestly, Emma, the challenge that I see most, and I don't know how to name this other than just to keep it simple and transparent, for those educators who have seen some level of success from a traditional approach, it's the notion of, if it's not broke, why are we trying to fix it? And it's not so much that we're trying to, quote unquote, fix it, but we do have a responsibility to evolve. And maybe it's a question of, is competency-based learning evolution, evolving or moving, or are we repairing something that was broken? If you just ask me my most immediate thought, I think it's both. I think it's a matter of both. And I think that the biggest advocate is the learner when he or she has had an experience to navigate through a competency-based instruction.
Yes, I've absolutely recognized the same feedback. And I think you're right. It's both. And every student learns differently. And every student needs their education to be tailored to what works for them.
So it's that notion of tailoring it for oneself. Right? That you can curate your learning experience, that it is customized, not only to your learning, but to your learning style and your learning pace. And there lies a win that we have to embrace. Because here's the thing, whether we do it or not, others have, and it only puts us further behind when we do not. Just wanted to name that. You just said that, and I just wanted to double tap on that.
Thank you. So Dr. Herring, as we come to a close at WGU, every student is paired with a mentor, and the mentor is by their side from the day they enroll to the day they graduate. And we are big proponents of mentors in people's lives. You mentioned one earlier, but I just wanted to ask, could you talk about someone who has been a really meaningful mentor to you that you just wanted to give a shout out to as we close out the podcast?
So I have been blessed, Emma, that I have multiple mentors. I'll be honest, all of them have been women leaders. So my first natural mentor is my mother, right? Because I think that's true for many of us, but it's not necessarily everyone's journey. Professionally speaking, I want to shout out Sylvia McGee. Sylvia McGee became my mentor in 2006. She was deputy superintendent in Bibb County Public Schools. Quite honestly, she's now just a leader still in Macon, Georgia in our community. But not only did she tell me that she would be mentoring me, she has followed me along my journey. My first superintendency, Sylvia was there to just stand and celebrate this opportunity that I had. And I even got a key to the city because of her having watched my career. She's also a thought partner. She's, for me, because I'm a woman of faith, she's a thought partner, she's a prayer partner, and she's someone that I can call with anything relative to the work or otherwise. And there's always a book she'll say, Lisa, read this one. Lisa, what did you think here? When I was making my decision about saying yes to the superintendency in Birmingham, that meant actually that I had to say no to a superintendency in another state. I was given two offers at the same time. Sylvia was my thought partner. She was my thought partner when I transitioned to Atlanta. She's the one who says, she'll text. I know you probably don't have time to call. Just text me. Thumbs up. I just need to know that you're okay. She watches the news. So everyone needs a mentor. They need a coach. They need someone who they feel comfortable and confident with and that they can receive the feedback, whether it's agreeable or disagreeable, because they know it's in their best interest. Shout out to Mrs. Sylvia McGee, retired interim superintendent from Bibb County Public Schools. And now she works with United Way and many other nonprofits in Macon, making a difference. And quite honestly, she was recently recognized across the city for that same type of passion for the work to serve and help others.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And here's to Sylvia McGee at United Way for making you, and I'm sure so many others, feel comfortable and confident. I think that that is so critical to all of our journeys. And I know that you serve as a mentor to many others and a reminder to our listeners to be a mentor and to thank your mentors. So, Dr. Herring, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. We really appreciate it.
I'm honored that you thought enough of me to extend time and space. So it's been my pleasure. If anyone wants to learn more about me, we're releasing a website, www.drlisaherring.com. It's live now, and we'll release that at the end of the week, but it is live. It's my life's assignment to do this work, Emma. And so I'm humbled and grateful and always just thoughtful about what we can do to change and impact education. And so kudos to you all for being a leader in this work and thinking of all of us in a very deliberate way.
Thank you, Dr. Herring.
Sage Advice is brought to you by Western Governors University. To learn more about WGU and how it's pioneering a new path in higher education, visit wgu.edu. If you enjoyed our discussion today, don't forget to subscribe to Sage Advice wherever you get your podcasts. Join us next time for more insightful conversations. Until then, keep learning, keep growing, and keep pushing the boundaries of what education can achieve. From the team here at WGU, thank you for listening to Sage Advice.